The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. I hope you can only hear one of me. On the pod today, the Champions League. Manchester United go very late 90s with a display of attacking verve and intent. Won't someone think of the narrative? Questions. Why can't they do this against West Brom? Can you play Van der Beek, Pogba and Fernandes together and just have fun? And are the players now just trolling Barney with their penalty run-ups? Elsewhere, Chelsea leave it late. Let's see how Wilson's feeling about them generally looking quite good all over the pitch. We'll ask who's better, Martin Braithwaite or Erling Braut Haaland. There's some Italian questions for Nicky, and Barry has a dream about Martin Keown. We'll address that at the end. As always, your questions are better than mine, so we'll add them in, put it all together, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how you doing?
Yeah, tremendous, thank you. Hello, Nicky Bandini.
Morning.
Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Now, we start with an apology. On the last pod, for reasons that none of us can identify, my voice came through more than once. We did rectify it, but you know, unless you unsubscribed and subscribed again, you would have heard it in quite a strange fashion. Ghosts of Harrenhal says, I thought I could not get enough, Max Rushton. I stand corrected. Flumps Cloud, after the echo fest of the last pod, you've dispelled the consensus that you can't get any more annoying. Apologies to Wayne Brown, who says, I must go and retrieve my headphones from the bin. I thought I'd broken another set. And Bloody Ear Gimp says, how many Max Rushtons will be presenting tomorrow's pod? Any tweaks to the experimental two up top or back to the lone roll? Yes, no idea how that happened, but hopefully... there'll just be one of me. I don't know. I certainly didn't repeat everything I said during the last pod. Let's begin with Manchester United's 4-1 victory over Istanbul Başakşehir. That was better, wasn't it? Johnny Lou saying this was a game about aspiration, about the sort of football United can produce with the handbrake off Van der Beek and Fernandes in midfield. It was fun, Jonathan, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But would it have been fun if I hadn't scored quite so early? I mean, that's always the thing with United. When the opposition has to come at them or chooses to come at them, they're very good at hitting the spaces behind them. What they're not very good at is breaking down mass defences. So 3 weeks ago in Istanbul, Başakşehir sat fairly deep and did them on the break, scored twice on the break, and Tuanzebe could have been sent off for a foul that stopped the break. Here, as soon as Fernandes scores, it's a brilliant goal. The game's being played the way United want to be played. And when it is being played like that, they are very good.
But, Jonathan, to be fair, they did score early and it was a beautiful goal. And so, you know, I sort of feel we should give them the credit because quite often we're very critical very quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean, they played really well and they are very good at that when the game is being played in the way they want it to be played, as this was. So the thing that we knew they were good at again, and that's great. The thing they're not very good at, we didn't get to see. So it tells us very little.
Is it too cynical of me to say that they're good when Bruno Fernandes is good still? I mean, I know Van der Beek was good in this game as well. I'm not saying he was the only good player in this match, but he's such an influential player and it was such a beautiful strike, as Jonathan just alluded to. It does feel like a team that is certainly at a different level when he's on song like that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Fernandes is the player who makes that midfield tick. And the games where we've seen them unlock teams who are sitting deep against them, he tends to be the way they do it. And he was certainly in the first half, he was brilliant last night. The second goal was very straightforward, terrible goalkeeping error. I think Cavani played really well as well, which is obviously positive for United. But yeah, Fernandes is the creative hub of that midfield.
Could you put Van der Beek and Fernandes? I said in the intro and Pogba, but can you play Van der Beek? Because I think a lot of people want to see Van der Beek and think he's a very talented player, and he is a very talented player, and we haven't seen a lot of him.
Well, you've got that midfield, three, and the great thing I think about midfield threes is it's very easy to sort of tweak the balance of them. So you can play two holders and one creator, you can play three holders, you can play one holder and two creators. Van der Beek, I think, has a great range of talent. So he's one of those players who I think is really useful. And actually, I think Pogba should be able to do this and at his best can do this, who can adapt to the state of the game. He's sort of he's almost like a valve on the pitch that you can alter according to how the game's going. So I don't see why you couldn't play Van der Beek and Fernandes and McTominay or Fred or Matic as a holder, certainly against lesser opposition. And when you do need to break those teams down.
I would be of the opinion that Pogba has outstayed his usefulness at Manchester United. He's too unreliable. On his day, he's capable of brilliant performances, but those days are very far and few between. Fernandes is remarkably consistent, and if he can avoid injury, will probably, you know, be a constant presence in the team. And Donny van der Beek just is young and seems to be hungrier than Pogba. He may not be quite as good yet, but I would rather depend on him than Pogba if Manchester United had to win a football match to save my life.
I would pay $14.95 to see that.
Nicky, was Pogba like miles more consistent at Juventus?
I feel like this is like the inevitable question we always come back to. Oh, Pogba Juventus. It's quite a long time now. Like, yeah, it's been a while since he was at Juventus. He was a very different player probably when he was at Juventus. He was playing in a different context. I mean, it was a fantastic, again, three-man midfield, like Jonathan was talking about, the versatility and range they had in that group. And it was Vidal and Pirlo and Pogba. And then you could also bring in Marchisio. You had sort of such a versatile dynamic in that group. And you could use several of those players in different ways. But I think Pogba is capable of being a very a versatile, can't think of a different word, can't think of any elegant variation to change my sentence. Very versatile player. He can play in a box-to-box way. He can play in a quite sort of deep-lying distribution role he did at time for Juventus. He's got the passing range. Why it hasn't ever sort of, I don't know, quite clicked as everyone hoped it would as United is one of those not even million-dollar questions. It's many, many, many millions that have been spent on Paul Pogba, but I would quite like to selfishly see him somewhere else, whether it's back at Juventus, where I know they would certainly have him back, or just somewhere else entirely, because I think we've not seen everything that he can be in his career. And I think that sometimes context matters and being somewhere else could give him what he needs.
Barry, how nice of Bruno was it to give Rashford the penalty?
I suppose it was quite civic spirited of him. He doesn't seem to care about that kind of thing. I wouldn't either. A lot of players do. I don't think it's a big deal. People are making it out to be.
Well, I think it might be a big deal. It depends why he gave it to. Because his post-match interview was slightly ambiguous on that. Because he finished up by saying it's nice for Rashford to score goals and it's good for him to be the leading scorer in the Champions League and all that kind of stuff. Which I think is slightly odd. But you know, Rashford doesn't need his confidence building. But he began by saying, I told him after the Premier League game, which obviously is the West Brom game on Saturday, when he missed the penalty, then was able to retake it. So whether he's now got a slight doubt in his mind about his penalty taking and sort of thinks, yeah, he probably should see those responsibilities. And if it is that, if he is beginning to doubt himself, then that maybe is a bit more significant.
Digby says, please get Barney back on to discuss Rashford's penalty run-up. Brendan says, I caught this late as I was on holiday, but Barney on United's penalties made me laugh so hard, milk came out of my nose. I haven't drunk milk since 2013. And Owen says, 2020 has been rough for all of us. We need something to look forward to. Can we please round off the year by having Barry voice Barney's Manchester United VAR penalty rant against the backing track of Dry Your Eyes by The Streets? It's clearly what the people want. I'm certainly happy to make that happen as we approach Christmas.
Well, I'm not sure how me voicing it would be beneficial. I mean, it would only take away from what was a splendid soliloquy by Barney.
Perhaps we get Barney's soliloquy and then you just do the dry your eyes mate bit, you know, just because there's in the chorus. We'll workshop it. Somebody did get in touch to say it was very funny, but we did miss a sort of valid question about run-ups with the kind of the stuttery jobs that are now happening.
We really didn't. I mean, it's a stupid thing to discuss.
Well,
this has been going on since the days of John Aldridge. and his stuttering run-ups, like, that's a long, long time ago. How do you judge, if you don't stop in your run-up, if you do not cease moving, it's fine. It's a run-up. There's no law as to what style you have to adopt to run, you know.
But even the fact that the people think this is a debate worth having suggests how debased penalties have become. Because if a penalty is awarded for, you know, a critical foul near the goal, where we sort of think, yeah, the appropriate reward is to have a free shot on goal, we would want most penalties to be scored, and we would encourage, you know, whatever it takes to make the goal most likely to sufficiently punish the foul play that's led to it. But because penalty is now awarded because a ball's looked at your hand, we now think it's a farce, which it is. And so that's now, rather than correcting the awarding of the penalties, we're now sort of trying to downgrade the likelihood of scoring the penalties. I mean, I don't even think it was a penalty. You know, Rashford sort of cuts across and he initiates the contact with the defender and then bounces off him. It's not even his heel's being clipped. He sort of runs shoulder to shoulder into the defender. It's the definition of a manufactured penalty.
I thought Ballingoli definitely barged into him. Rashford did cut across him, as he is perfectly entitled to do, but there was a definite shove.
Nah.
I mean, Ballingoli has already shown he's not the sharpest tool in the shed from his antics when he was at Celtic during lockdown. I wasn't aware he'd been shipped off to Brzezinski on loan, but that's where I was surprised to see him turn up.
As a definitions of manufactured penalties go, I think Angel Di Maria would have a shout for it.
Oh, that's much worse.
Last night.
I mean, that game was a disgrace. Yeah. I mean...
Yeah, well, let's move on to it. How is that penalty not overturned? That's what I can't understand. Unless it's VAR not there?
It's a complete nonsense. Savitz is a little bit silly to even get close enough to him, but it's a dive. Having been awarded the penalty, having got the penalty, PSG then get away with two horrendous tackles in the last 10 minutes by Herrera and then Verratti, both of which should have been straight reds. They were both terrible, terrible fouls. And yeah, this is where you sort of just despair of where the game's going. That kind of, we're taking out a microscope to find the tiniest handball, and yet people are allowed to just sort of go lunging in knee high on opponents. So I'd leave an opponent with literally bleeding from his thigh, and it's somehow only a yellow card.
I do think it's like an inevitability of these sorts of technologies that people try to sort of try to reduce nuanced decisions into black and white decisions. And that's why handball has become such a focus, is because it can be reduced to, if you choose to do it this way, has the ball hit an arm or not? And so it becomes like this clear line that you can sort of say and yes or no. Whereas every contact between players is going to be on some level subjective. I agree with you, by the way, Jonathan. I think that the decisions in this game were terrible, but I think that's why we end up where we end up.
But my mind is still blown that penalty is not overturned. I sort of just can't see any point in having VAR at all without wanting to sound like everyone else shouting about this, but just watching that going, that's so ridiculous. Like, has the referee, has the people, is there VAR? Like, I'm sitting there going, I'm sure there is VAR in the Champions League, but maybe there isn't. Have they never seen a football match? Have like none of the people in that room seen a person dive before? It's, I just found it so infuriating.
Well, it may well be the case that if your job entails sitting, staring at a screen, as all of us are doing now, your mind wanders, you get distracted. You know, if you're, whether you're doing this, whether you're a security guard in a shopping centre or a casino or, you know, whatever, you are going to lose interest and get bored. Maybe that's what happened.
Well, no, but it was like, how far into the game was it? It was only, like, you know, I don't know how many games they do. It was about a minute in, wasn't it? When was it? 11 minutes.
Well, maybe they were still making the tea. They hadn't actually sat down yet.
I always thought that with the goal line officials, the ones who just sort of stood there and just had no other job for most of the game, but just sort of waiting by the goal line for something to happen. How you sort of keep your attention the whole time is...
But Barry, I don't know if you've come across this, but on a lot of video players now, they've got a rewind button. It's, yeah, the one with the two arrows pointing from right to left. And like maybe they could use that when for instance, a penalty has just been awarded. That would seem a good time to use it.
I'd like to hope they've gone even better and they've got the 10 seconds back button. So that, like, you've got Netflix where you can just go back 10 seconds rather than have to...
Yeah. United have 9 points. They just need one more point to qualify. PSG and Leipzig on 6. Man U PSG next. And then Leipzig away for them. So a bit of work to do.
Well, PSG were poor, really poor. That was a game I watched live. And they, I mean, in one way, they defended quite well. That Leipzig were sort of reduced to putting crosses across the box and long-range shots. But on the other hand, they only had 30% possession. They were really under pressure. Their goal came from a penalty that should have been a penalty. And it was similar to the first game between them, but they were okay for sort of 20 minutes, half an hour, and then they buckled really badly. And the way they lost discipline in that second half, and I think they ended up with 5 yellow cards, but 2 of them should have been reds. And yeah, Neymar was a bad Neymar of kind of chucking himself down all the time. And it was not a performance that suggested A, that Thomas Tuchel is long for that job, and B, that they really learned anything from getting to the final last year.
I think it's quite an interesting dynamic in that group, and certainly between those two teams, because I think feel like Leipzig have played pretty well all through the group. They obviously got beaten by United, but I think I felt like in that game they were really missing. It was that Timo Werner shaped hole that was just so obvious in their team, and I think in this game again, when you haven't got an attacker who can finish it all off, sometimes you really feel it. Whereas PSG haven't played well, but even in the context of not playing well in this game, there was at least one moment when you saw Mbappe bring the ball forward from the edge of his own penalty area, feed it to Neymar, take the return ball. He got brought down inside the area. It was a legal challenge, but a sliding challenge that was sort of required to stop this from being Mbappe through on goal. And it reminds you that just two players can do a lot when they're as good as those two players, even if the team isn't playing well.
And neither of them are fully fit at the moment either. So yeah, that's absolutely the case. And also they now have the advantage on the head-to-head. They've got the away goals advantage. So they only have to match Leipzig's results. On the other hand, PSG are playing United away and in a game where United need to get something, whereas Leipzig might be playing United who have already qualified.
Imagine not being fully fit and being that fast at running. It's just not it's not fair, is it? Rennes 1, Chelsea 2. So Chelsea qualified with 2 games to spare. Olivier Giroud, on as a late sub, scored the winner. It's a great header as well. What a guy he is, Barry.
I'm a huge Olivier Giroud fan. What a handsome man he is. I mean, he's just so handsome. But that aside, he's one of the best headers of a ball I've ever seen. That was a brilliant headed goal by him. The timing of the jump, the power he got behind it, even the defender on the line who tried to palm it clear, wasn't able to keep it out. And we're in this annual cycle where it's that time of year where his agent start making noises saying he needs a move to get first team football, to get in the French team. He seems to get in the French team whether he plays or not, or certainly in the squad. I really think Chelsea, for all their assets going forward in attack, I really think they should do whatever they can to hold on to him. But he's 6 years left, or 6 months left on his contract. And I think quite a few teams in Europe would pay a nice bit of money for him nonetheless.
So, have we done this question on the pod, or did I do it on the radio, Barry? I forget. What Premier League side would he start for? Because you start looking down the league and you think, actually, there aren't that many that he would start for. I wonder if it's different in Serie A. Would he walk into like one of the top teams? I just sort of wonder if he would.
Don't know if he'd walk into, because a lot of the top teams in Italy have really good centre-forward options right now. Obviously, Inter have Lukaku and Lautaro. Juventus have Ronaldo and Alvaro Morata. Lazio have Ciro Immobile. A lot of these teams have really good options. I think Roma might be a very good fit if they were thinking of it, because they've got Edin Dzeko. In his absence, Henrik Mkhitaryan has been leading the line very effectively, but you haven't really got a second centre forward after Dzeko. And Dzeko is, what, 34 now, 35, currently out with a coronavirus infection. So, yes, there would certainly be space for him in a team like that. And actually, Roma are very upwardsly mobile right now. They're playing great football under Paolo Fonseca. So that could be an interesting fit if they were looking that way.
Hudson-Odoi's goal was lovely. Beautiful pass from Mason Mount. Cesc Fabregas tweeted, Mason Mount, fantastic. Jonathan, would you like to give a sort of 1-2 minute précis of how you feel Chelsea are at the moment? Because they are lovely going forward, have shored up at the back, you know, are in the title race.
Yeah, no, they're playing really well at the minute. Mason Mount, I think at the minute, looks one of the best midfielders in the Premier League. I mean, that goal, it wasn't just the pass was perfect, it was the selection of pass, because he had Tammy Abraham, who I guess, you know, he knew would be there. He had Werner making the break. So Werner was already running. So the easy ball is just knocking over the top for Werner. And he, you know, he checks himself and plays the ball to Hudson-Odoi. And I guess because he's playing it right footed, that means the ball's sort of curving into his path. And it was, of the three possible passes, it was the right one to play, but probably the least obvious of the three. And he plays it perfectly. And his versatility, his tactical intelligence, yeah, every time I see him, I'm sort of more impressed by him. You're going forward, they've obviously got fantastic options. Werner seems to manage to be incredibly influential despite missing a good chance every game. Ziyech has settled really quickly. Havertz hasn't quite settled as well, and he's had the issues with the positive COVID test. But you know, we know he's a really good player, and because everybody else is playing so well, there's no immediate pressure on him. Tammy Abraham looks to play who he was beginning of last season. He was finishing really well. Giroud gives them that option. The midfield looks much better since Kante began playing, you know, as the deepest of the three, which he's done for the last three league games, though he didn't play last night. So everything looks great. The defence looks much better, and that may be Mendy coming in, so they actually have a goalkeeper who saves shots, which is useful. Thiago Silva had that nightmare at West Brom, or the first half at West Brom, but has been really good since, has given them that authority they maybe lacked. Chilwell, I think, has fitted in really well, not just defensively, but also he gives them the creativity and the goals that Marcos Alonso at his best did. Reece James, I think, is a really good right back, and if it weren't for Trent Alexander-Arnold, we'd be raving about him, and probably we should still be raving about him. So everything looks great, and they've only let in 2 goals in the last 8 games since the Southampton game. The big caveat, 2 caveats, the smaller one first, is both at Newcastle and last night, having completely dominated the early stages, they switch off a bit, which I guess is understandable when you're so much better than the opposition and when you've got all these games, it's sort of fatigue and a bit of complacency settles in. But the Newcastle game, they won comfortably enough anyway. And last night they had the wherewithal, having conceded the equaliser, to then find a winner. But the big caveat is, in those 8 games, they only conceded 2 goals. They haven't really played anybody. Yeah, they've played a Sevilla side who are in the middle of a run of scoring 4 goals in 7 games. They played Manchester United in a game where both teams just sat in their own half and looked at the opposition and barely went forward. And then they played, Rennes twice, one of them against 10 men, Krasnodar, and 3 other teams, who are Sheffield United, Burnley and Newcastle. So the real test comes when they play a team like Tottenham at the weekend, who are very good at counter-attacking, and that was something Chelsea were not good at defending against last season, or even in the early part of this season. And the other caveat would be the goal they conceded against Rennes was a cross-set play, which has been a perennial problem, and it was a bad goal to concede. You know, they didn't pick him up at all. So, yeah, as they should be, given the money spent, they're looking really good. But there is that doubt. They have had quite a comfortable fixture list, and I think they've got Everton, Wolves and Leeds coming up after Spurs.
The highlight of the game for me, highlight, and I felt bad for him, but like Gomez's yell after Giroud scored at the end was just so dramatic, and even sort of better contrast when you saw Giroud's post-game interview where like he was just so nonchalant about it. He was like, oh, you know, it's like, it's nice to score a goal. Like it's nice to find 10p on your morning walk. But Gomez was anguished. Gomez sounded like it was just, yeah. And in an empty stadium, I really felt it. I felt quite bad for him.
It's like Apocalypse Now or like The Shining or something. It was just, yeah, it was chilling, wasn't it? The other moment of the game was Aspilicueta getting one right in the undercrackers, which he would have been duty bound or certainly allowed to make the same sort of noises. Sevilla also threw. They beat Krasnodar 2-1. Rakitic scored a lovely half volley in this game, and Sevilla tweeted how everyone in the Europa League is feeling right now with the gif of Alan Pardew dancing. As obviously Sevilla have won the Europa League for the last 16 years in a row. Sevilla-Chelsea next week, which will probably decide who wins the group. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Barcelona's win in Kiev. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Group G then. Barcelona won 4-0 at Dynamo Kiev. Sid Lowe, take my breath away. Lars Sivertsen, the breath wait is over. They left Messi and De Jong at home. Martin Braithwaite turned up in the second half. Griezmann got one off the bench. The youngest team they've put out in the Champions League in 15 years. They go through to the knockout rounds. Dear Matisse, can anyone address the strange Braithwaite obsession? Yes, he used to be at Middlesbrough. Yes, he has an English surname. Barcelona signed him. It shouldn't be a shock that he's turned out to be quite good at football. What's our obsession with Martin Braithwaite?
Well, he's right. I mean, there's so many players have gone from Barcelona to Middlesbrough. Such a well-worn path.
So, did Phil Stamp? Was he? Phil Stamp did that, didn't he?
No. Narrowly, he got that injury just before the medical. Oh, it was heartbreaking for him.
But you know, he's sort of got a point, hasn't he? There are occasionally no. He doesn't have a point.
No, of course he doesn't.
Oh, all right. Okay,
Braithwaite is at Barcelona only because of Spain's farcical injury law that allows, you know, if you're a big club, you can steal a little club's players just because one of your players is feeling a bit off that week. It doesn't matter whether it's in a window or not. That's the only reason he went. He's a decent player, but he's a decent, you know, mid-table La Liga player. He's not a Barcelona level player. And fair play to him.
But, you know, he probably is at the moment, to be fair.
Well, okay, yeah, but yeah, he should make the most of the opportunity, and you know, good luck to him. But the idea that this is not somehow slightly odd is odd.
Well, there you've been told, damn it. If you want to ask any more questions, then
don't.
You can. Don't. Poor Dermot. Some people, Nicky, suggesting this might be the moment that sparked Antoine Griezmann into life. Or was it just a late goal in Kiev?
It was a really nice goal. It was a really, really well taken finish on the turn. One of those sort of really sort of, I don't know, goals that shows off his technical ability. But I don't know. I mean, Barcelona have got 11 points in 8 league games compared to 12 in 4 Champions League games. It might just be that the games they're playing in the Champions League are generally a bit easier than the ones they're playing in La Liga. He's a very good player. It should work at some point. I don't want to predict off the face of that one goal. He's suddenly going to be unlocked and flying.
Michael says, thoughts on Barca wearing their away kit against Dynamo Kiev? Might be the most unnecessary of all time. I mean, it happens so frequently now that I've almost stopped caring. It's a bit like serious things in the world that keep happening that you stop caring about because even though you should keep caring about them, I want to keep caring, but I can't because it's just endless. Like why Chelsea wore blue last night, but they couldn't wear real blue. They had to, you know, wear Aquafresh blue. Like it can somebody keep caring about it on my behalf because I've run out of patience with caring.
I can't. It's not something that exercises me at all. I think all these talking points that are being brought up are just people clutching or grabbing at lifelines because I don't know if maybe it's just me, but I just find this season's Champions League utterly depressing. I have little or no interest in it. Like, I rarely have interest in the group stages at the best of times. Some matches are good, some aren't, but you generally know who's going to qualify. But this season, with most of the games being played in empty stadiums, I just finding it incredibly difficult to give a shit who goes through or who doesn't.
I had no idea you were in the pocket of Big Kit, Barry, defending the use of needless second kits.
Juve 2, Ferencváros 1. Ronaldo scored a lovely equaliser. Got a couple at the weekend too. He's got 70 goals in Champions League home games, a joint record of home goals with Messi. But who is better? That's the question. Wasn't it a great? It was such a lovely goal, Nicky, wasn't it?
It was a lovely goal. It was a lovely goal in a not lovely performance from Juventus. I still don't think there's any sort of balance to this Andrea Pirlo plan. I think he wants to play this ambitious attacking football, which when you get the ball, you've got five players joining the attack. But then what happened in practice in this game is you've just got constantly the fullbacks getting ahead of the ball. Ferencváros were playing a pretty smart game, trying to play them on the counter. They got the first goal. They could have scored again, frankly. Juventus, had a lot of the ball, struggled to break them down. I think if there's sort of any real narrative out of this game, it's just that Dybala still looks like a foreign object, in particular in Pirlo's teams. He doesn't seem to have found his role at all. And it was Alvaro Morata coming off the bench in the second half to replace him that turned things around. I mean, we know he's going to score goals like that. He's still doing it at 36. But Morata's impact, especially given that Ronaldo has been out for a bunch of these games, he's got 5 goals in 4 Champions League games. Morata is a big, big reason why Juventus are going to move smoothly through to the knockout stages in a time when they haven't particularly played all that great.
They're not playing great in the moment in the league either, are they? Do you think, like, how much grace does Pirlo have? Like, 1, 2, 10 years because he's Andrea Pirlo?
I don't know. I did say... I can't remember if I said it here, I certainly said it elsewhere, like earlier, before Ronaldo came back, because Ronaldo being out obviously is a loss and you can't deny that. But before Ronaldo came back and the results started to improve, I was asking if this was anyone else, would they not be getting more criticism than he has? Because he hasn't faced too much heat yet. The expectation for the season is the same as it is for every season. The minimum bar has been the league. And then after that, you're supposed to be competing for the Champions League. They're hardly out of touch. I think they're 4 points behind Milan, but the fact that they're not front running is already something. I think it's too early to draw serious conclusions. And I think as long as he wins the league, he's not going to get chased out of town too quickly. But he certainly seems to have got a bit of extra grace because he's put a lot in terms of the criticism he received during the period, again, while Ronaldo was out and they weren't getting results at home.
Dortmund 3, Bruges 0, 2 goals for Erling Braut Haaland. He's got 4 against Hertha at the weekend. He's scored 15 goals in 12 Champions League games. The next best to reach 12 goals in the Champions League is 19 games. That was Van Nistelrooy and Soldado. You know when you run out of questions, like about Ronaldo or Messi? I've run out of questions about Haaland and he's only 20. You know, like, this is a professional issue for me. Like, he's got another 10 years at least. If he goes on like Zlatan, he's got 20 years at the top of his game. And I have nothing more to ask about Erling Braut Haaland. Does anyone have anything new to say about Erling Braut Haaland?
It's not a question, but I thought the way he took his, I think it was the opening goal, last night, when he sort of had it at the near post, and you look at him, he's such a hulk, he's such a big, imposing guy. You think he's just going to smash it, but instead he kind of faked the keeper out and basically just side-footed it in off the near post. I thought that sort of was a more evidence of, I guess, the surprising level of nuance there is to his game for someone at that age with those physical tools. But yeah, he's ridiculous. He's very, very good. I do find it slightly, there's a bit of me that wants to roll my eyes at stats like the one you just said, because people are like, it's a record, first pair to 15 goals. Like, 15 is some number we've always chased. Like, oh, who's going to be the first to 15?
Actually 12, not even 15. No, I take your point. I was just trying to say something new about him. You're right. I mean, he's really good, isn't he?
Max, the main talking point about this game involves a player who wasn't on the pitch, Club Bruges' Emmanuel Dennis, who refused to travel because he stormed off the team bus in a massive hissy fit because he couldn't sit in his favourite seat for some reason or other. I'm not sure what that reason was, but
yeah, I can't believe that's true. Like, I also read that story, I have it written here, but that can't be true, can it? Can that really be true? Man has to sit on seat on bus. It's amazing.
I want it to be true. I could really get behind that kind of diva-ness.
You were finding the Champions League boring, but now a man won't sit on a seat. We can't get the back seat on the bus. Suddenly, it's turned into a different game, hasn't it? We should mention Jadon Sancho's free kick because it was a beautiful strike, and he's a very good footballer as well. Lazio beat Zenit 3-1. Ciro Immobile with a beautiful goal, Nicky, in the third minute.
Yeah, Ciro Immobile, who... of course, was missing for a couple of Champions League games. There is an ongoing saga that it's probably too deep to get into with COVID testing hanging over Lazio at the moment. But turns out when Ciro Immobile is on the pitch, this team looks even sharper. I have to say, what happens will happen with the investigations into the COVID testing. But as just an on-pitch performance judgment, I think that Lazio have done really flipping well in this group because they've been missing Immobile, who reminded us of how important he is for them in this game. Another gem of a goal, as you mentioned. Missing him, missing other starters, they've got through, you know, the trickiest three games. I suppose they've still got to go away to Dortmund, but three very tricky games to start the group. Playing Dortmund at home, then their two away games against the other two. They've now won the first of their home games against the other two. It's an impressive passage through this group for a team who haven't been in the Champions League, for a team that is not used to being here. I think Simone Inzaghi is doing a really impressive job still with this group. And yes, now they're in a pretty commanding position where they basically just have to not lose one of the next two games and they'll be through.
Wilson, you wanted to discuss Artem Dzyuba, who scored in this game.
Yeah, he's just had an extraordinary month that his phone was hacked and a video from his phone was released showing him pleasuring himself on a bed. And this led to him being dropped from the Russia squad. He was stripped of the Zenit captaincy. He was brought into the team again against Krasnodar. Most of the fans were supportive of him, but there was a group who thought he should have been dropped entirely. He scored the winner in that game. He then revealed that his father had died a couple of days before that game. And then in support of him, and this is the most extraordinary bit of the whole story, there was a flight going from Moscow to Yekaterinburg where the pilots reported some kind of navigational difficulties and said they'd have to leave the flight plan. And they traced on the radar the shape of enormous phallus in support of Dzyuba, which is now being investigated by the Russian Aviation Authority. And if you look on, be careful when you Google this. If you Google this, you will see a very carefully drawn cock and balls pointing from Moscow to Yekaterinburg.
I did see somewhere that's sort of a lockdown challenge on Strava. So if you're going cycling or running or walking, you get your Strava map and try and do like a cock and balls, which...
Well, it's not that... I mean, that isn't that difficult. I think doing it in a plane...
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I guess maybe if you pilot, it's not that different, but it's... you're certainly taking on greater authorities by doing that.
Do you think you'd notice as a passenger going, hang on a second, I feel like that's just going round.
I'm not sure if it was a passenger flight or if it was a cargo flight.
Ah, sorry. I see. Oh, it makes a big difference. Few questions on Italy for you, Nicky. James says, please tell me Zlatan will be okay. I don't care whether you know for sure or not. I just need to hear it. What's happened to Zlatan?
Well, there's slightly different reports about the severity of it, but it sounds like he has either a muscle strain or a muscle tear, which took him out of this weekend's win over Napoli late on. He has scored, is it 10 goals in 6 games there? Is it 10 goals in 5 games? I'm not sure. But he's scoring a lot of goals for Milan and he's certainly been very, very impressive. I'm not sure Milan need to panic without him. I understand you look at those goal numbers and it's pretty significant loss. But actually, they did do without him several times last season after he arrived. He arrived and immediately hit the ground, had this big impact. But actually, I think this Milan team have certainly needed him as an experienced figurehead and his goals have been very, very helpful in lots of games. But I think this team will be okay without him. I think they're actually on a really good path at the moment. So if you want reassurance, it's probably that. I think Milan can win even with the other players they've got. They're Ante Rebic, Rafael Leao. They've got other guys who can score goals.
Mad says, question for Nicky. Why has Christian Eriksen failed so miserably at Inter? Is it beyond performance, brackets, language issues, or does Conte just have better players than him?
Well, it's interesting you bring up the language issue, because Romelu Lukaku sort of mentioned it in an interview he gave while he was away on international duty. Someone was asking him about Eriksen. He said, oh, well, maybe it hasn't helped. He hasn't been able to pick up Italian as quickly. Obviously, Lukaku is one of those extraordinary individuals who speaks a lot of languages very, very well, and certainly was speaking Italian pretty quickly after getting there. I think a lot of that stuff is more complicated when you're spending a lot of your time in lockdown. You know, speaking from experience, being in a different country, you pick up languages quicker when you're there and practicing them. But there's certainly a feeling that he's not going to get things righted into. When he first arrived last January, it was like he was supposed to be this last piece to get them up with Juventus and challenge the title. He didn't really play that much. People said, oh, well, Conte isn't really using a number 10. This season, Conte is using a number 10. But the summer sort of... brief summer such as it was, came and went, and Inter came back with a different formation using a number 10, Eriksen in the team. Everyone thinks, okay, this is like Conte's taken the break. He's going to make Eriksen work. But already Eriksen's lost that position. It's now Nicola Barella playing there and playing really, really well, by the way. Barella's probably the second most impressive player for Inter this season after Lukaku, who remains absolutely on fire there. I don't see how it's going to work. And you look at the weekend when they were 2-0 down to Torino, and Conte's looking for changes from his bench, and he doesn't call on Eriksen. He calls on Perisic. He calls on Nainggolan. Eriksen sat there on the bench going like, you know. So I do think Eriksen's going to struggle to find a way back into that team at the moment. There is some sort of big stuff to work out in terms of he's got a big salary and a long contract now. The club, I think, well, Pepe Marotta said it in basically not unsettled terms, like, we're not going to keep a player against their will. So they are willing to sell him, but is someone going to give them what they want for a player they spent 20 million on when he only had 6 months on his contract and who has a big salary? Where's he going to find that's willing to pick him up?
I think it's such an interesting sort of insight into just the kind of sliding doors moments for footballers, and, you know, your whole life defined by when you stay and when you move and when you don't. Because sort of 2 or 3 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know if there really was serious interest from Real Madrid and or Barcelona, but he was at such a level where he could have made a move at a different time.
Yeah, you know? And I think what makes this situation more complicated is COVID-19, because everyone has smaller budgets. That's the problem. Like, I think in a normal transfer setting, someone would pay what they want for him, because I think that actually he's done things that are impressive recently enough. People haven't forgotten about them. He's not old, he's not young, but I think he's 29. So he's got plenty of time left to come good. I just think that the transfer backdrop at the moment is really tough to find the sort of buyer you need for him. He might well still find one. And I think it would not be anything like a shock to see him go in January. It's just a question of who's going to come up with the goods. But yeah, unfortunately, it really does seem like the situation at Inter has gone very sour for him very quickly.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the Monday night games in the Premier League, do any other business, and listen to Barry's dream. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So on Monday in the Premier League, Burnley beat Palace 1-0. Wolves drew with Southampton. I do wonder if the teams who are picked for the Monday night game at 5:30 take it as such a personal insult that they then go on to produce sort of complete apathy on a football pitch. I don't think there's been a good 5:30 Monday night game. Or I think there's another one. Isn't there like a 5:30 or a 6 o'clock Friday night one? On paper, they look bad, and then in reality, they're even worse. But
quite nice just to have on, though. You just sort of finishing your work for the day, and you sort of think, oh, I'm about to make dinner. Oh, look, there's a game at 5:30. I don't really care about that. I'll go and chop the carrots.
They're like jazz. You know, are they like jazz or classic FM? Is that what you think they are?
I mean, that seems like a musical question, but yes, perhaps.
It was their first win of the season, the first goal at Turf Moor in more than 320 minutes of football. They say it's such a shame that fans haven't been there. Maybe they've timed it right for Burnley fans. In the Wolves-Southampton game, I mean, a lot of people were talking about, you know, Theo Walcott and the gap between his last goal for Southampton and this one. Duncan Alexander's was good. The gap between Theo Walcott's last two league goals for Southampton is 2.5 years longer than the Napoleonic Wars.
I always feel slightly guilty about Theo Walcott because...
Oh, what did you do to him?
Well, I was at his first ever start on a Saturday. So he played for Southampton at Leeds midweek and had scored, which I think maybe was his first start. I don't think that was his debut. And then on the Saturday, they played away at Millwall, and I was doing that game. And he scored after about a quarter of an hour in that game. It was a terrible back pass he ran onto. And I'd sort of been sent to do this big Theo Walcott piece. And to be honest, he was rubbish. He scored this one goal, and he just ran quite quickly in straight lines. And I wrote this, and he got sent back saying, do you want to just tweak that and not actually, you know, tell the truth, but kind of, yeah, make it a bit more kind of bigging up this 16-year-old who has just scored two goals in two games, which I did. And then I was at the World Cup in 2006. I was in Baden-Baden, and amid all that sort of wag nonsense, one of my abiding memories of that spell, quite apart from Sean Ingle getting bitten on the arse by a big Alsatian in a restaurant, was the very sad sight of Theo Walcott's dad sitting alone outside the Curry House in Baden-Baden and just looking bewildered and slightly dismayed by this kind of wag nonsense going on around him. And so I sort of feel I was there at the beginning of the Walcott story, and then it's just sort of fizzled away, and I've been very critical of him, and actually his career's been all right. You know, he got that hat-trick in Zagreb, he scored, you know, more than 100 goals for Arsenal. He, you know, he's won a couple of FA Cups. He seems a very pleasant young man. Well, not that young anymore. A very pleasant early middle-aged man. And yeah, he took his goal very well on Monday. Maybe I've been too harsh on him. Maybe I expected too much.
Did Jonathan Wilson just own up to being the fake news media?
Yeah, he did.
Telling stories that weren't true because an editor demanded it.
And he's having a go at Barry for being in the pocket of Big Kit.
How did you know it was Theo Walcott's dad sitting outside a Curry House? And what exactly were Victoria Beckham and Carly Cole and others doing that were making him look so sad?
Well, it was more that, I mean, we knew it was him because he'd been interviewed a lot about his son going to the World Cup aged 3.5 or whatever he was at the time. And he sat at the same seat in the same Curry House every day. I went there once. It was decent. I went back 2017. It was still there, the curry house. I took a photo at Theo Walcott's dad's table.
Okay.
There was no plaque, but hopefully we can get that changed. I went back and paid homage at the spot where Ingle shed blood. I don't know. I guess it was a nice quiet spot where he wasn't going to get disturbed by all the craziness going on around him.
Okay, arguably more importantly, crowds of up to 4,000 people will be allowed to return to sporting events in England from next week. Grassroots sport will resume as part of an easing of coronavirus restrictions announced by the Prime Minister. Once the changes are implemented, 4,000 spectators will be allowed into outdoor events in Tier 1 areas, or 50% of the capacity, depending on which is smaller, and 1,000 people will be allowed to attend indoor events. Ben Fisher wrote today that some lower league clubs believe they'll be out of pocket if they admit small numbers of supporters. One League Two club estimating their stewarding and security costs will soar to around 15,000 a home game, compared with 1,300 behind closed doors. I spoke to Paul Barber yesterday, the CEO of Brighton, saying, yeah, you know, 4,000 is not enough. It's not a moneymaker for Brighton. They'll lose money on that, but it's, you know, a gesture of getting fans back into grounds. I suppose the point is, it's good that some fans are getting in. It's not the sort of Hollywood end of the pandemic, is it? You know, we just wake up one day and we can have 60,000 people going to Old Trafford, etc.
Well, it's also, you'd hope it's a, you know, it's a staging post that 4,000 this month, maybe 8,000 next month, maybe 12,000 the month after. And obviously is a break-even point, which, you know, from a couple of people I spoke to, they suggested 10,000 as a rule of thumb is about right. I don't know if you can reduce your stewarding because you're presumably only opening a smaller section of the ground. So maybe you need less stewarding, less security, I don't know. So yeah, I see how it could cause problems for smaller clubs who can't, you know, who don't have the reserves to cover that. But I also understand this is something that's got to be done as a process. You can't just suddenly have half the ground in So, yeah, it's good.
It is a step in the right direction, and I don't want to be that guy who immediately, when the government says you can do X amount, complain, well, why can't we do X amount plus a little bit more? But it does seem slightly odd that, you know, say if it's Anfield or Old Trafford or the Emirates, wherever, why can't you have a percentage of the capacity allowed in rather than this strict number? If it's to do with travel, then stagger the arrival times of those who are allowed go. And if people aren't prepared to wait 3 hours for kickoff, well then tough, give the tickets to someone else who is happy to do that, or allocate the tickets to people who live in a certain postcodes near the stadium so they can amble along, you know, sort of. It's not going to be a major inconvenience, and tubes aren't going to be crammed, and trains, whatnot. But yeah, it is definitely a step in the right direction.
Can I just say thank you to Paul Mullin, who scored a 95th minute equaliser for Cambridge United at Cheltenham. I had it on the laptop in silence. I did a double fist pump and cheered, and my wife thought I was particularly impressed with Peter's showstopper on the bake-off. Derby County, Steve McLaren's joined Derby for the fifth time, becoming the club's technical director and also an advisor to its board of directors. The former England head coach will begin with both roles immediately. Derby are bottom of the Championship under temporary management of Wayne Rooney, Liam Rossini, Shay Given and a few others. Now, Barry,
Did you see the Richard Jolly stat about that?
No, tell me.
So Richard Jolly's had two great stats this week. So his McLaren stat is McLaren has joined Derby under each of the last five Conservative Prime Ministers, but none of the Labour ones. And his other great stat was Daniel James's goal for Manchester United was the first goal by a Welshman for Manchester United in the Champions League since Ryan Giggs in 2011. In both games, Nemanja Matic came off the bench and one of the Da Silva twins played in each game.
Yeah, we love Richard Jolly. Hey, Barry, you'd like to apologise to Martin Keown?
Well, first of all, I think Mrs. Rushton probably didn't think you did a double fist pump because you were impressed with Peter's Bonkers Bake Off bubble cake, because it did actually have wet filling and dough that was tough and uncrispy. And I'd also like to draw the attention of anyone who isn't already aware of it to the Twitter account of 80s Footballers Aging Badly, which will only improve your mood.
It's so good, isn't it?
the FA Cup of aging 80s Footballers Aging Badly is currently in progress, and it's magnificent. And yeah, I had a dream last night. I don't normally remember my dreams. If I do, I don't normally tell people about them because it's almost as boring as hearing about other people's fantasy football teams. No one cares. But last night I had a weird dream where I woke up in quite a panic because Martin Keown and I had gone jet skiing. I was driving his, I think it was a Range Rover, but not a new modern one, an older model of a Range Rover. For some reason, I was driving and we parked on a slipway, you know, covered in ramps, covered in slimy green seaweed and whatnot, and to unload the jet skis from the trailer at the back. And in my haste to get out in the water with Martin so we could have fun together, I forgot to put the handbrake on, and we watched in horror as his Range Rover rolled forlornly into the depths of the sea. So, sorry about that, Martin.
Just a couple more bits for you, Barry. You mentioned you would travel to Australia for love at the end of last pod.
Well, I did mention that, but...
Well, Patty got in touch. 32-year-old Spurs fan from Sydney with a weakness for grumpy old men here. Send Barry down under for love.
Yeah, well, she'll have to make do with Alf Stewart or Flathead Fisher, I suspect, because it occurred to me after I'd said that, I've already said before that I won't even travel like three or four stops on the Northern Line for love. I'm so Australia is a bit of a stretch.
Oh, I can't believe you gave someone hope. Finally, in French at the end of the pod, Barry, I think you tried to say, would you like to go to bed with me? But you actually said, voulez-vous accoucher avec moi ce soir? Which means, And thank you to Ruto below the line saying, sounded like Barry asked Max if he wanted to give birth with him this evening, which is quite a stretch. Even how close we are, Barry. It's the film Junior with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Slightly different, isn't it? I don't know which one of us would be pregnant, but it's not something I want to think about.
Yeah. Well, I look more pregnant than you do.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Nikki, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Cheers, Barry.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.